thanks everybody for coming. I guess the idea of this opening talk was to actually climb up 30,000 feet and in this talk give the big picture, which will be refined during the next talks and over the next days. And of course, that discussion or this idea originally grew out of an S2PH discussion with Avery and Phil here in Canada at CETA and led to a couple of very exciting papers. At least they excited us and hopefully others. And we accumulated a couple of people in our collaboration, and I hope that, you guys will get excited about this as well and may write more papers about this. Let's get started. So first I will introduce blazars. Some of you may not know the phenomenology behind blazars. And in particular, I would like to introduce the plasma physics that you may encounter if a gamma ray TV gamma ray propagates through the universe. And if this picture that we propose is right, it could have a lot of cosmological consequences for the unifying pictures of blazars with AGN, for the gamma ray background, for the thermal history of the universe, for the Lyman Alpha Forest, and for the formation of dwarf galaxies. And I'd like to introduce all these different concepts in this talk, and of course, that can only be very shallowly done, so I hope that you guys will help me in the next couple of days that we sort of really go into the depth and the details and see whether things work or don't work. Now, what is an active galactic nucleus? It's a compact region at the center of a galaxy which dominates the luminosity of its electromagnetic spectrum. And one nice example here is Centaurus A, situated about 4 megaparsecs from us. So the AGN emission here is most likely caused by accretion, mass accretion onto a supermassive black hole. And this black hole system apparently can also launch relativistic jets, as you can see here. So AGNs don't only exist in our cosmological backyard, they also exist at large distances. In fact, those are among the most luminous sources in the universe. And one of these nice examples is the quasar 3C175, situated at a distance of, or at a redshift of 0.8, so it emitted its light when the universe was only half its current age. And here, the head-to-head, the distance here extends over more than 1 million light years across. So quite enormous objects. So what is the engine underlying these jets? Well, we believe, at least in this unified model, that a dusty torus surrounds an accretion disk that accretes matter onto the supermassive black hole, and somehow this supermassive black hole system is able to eject these relativistic jets. If these jets lie in the plane of the sky, we talk about a radio galaxy. If the jet points towards you, we talk about a blazar. So far, the idea of the unified model. Now, because of the relativistic beaming associated, if the jet points towards us, we can observe electromagnetic emission up to TV energies. And in fact, a number of collaborations successfully now pursued designs of the TV sky. MAGIC has in Veritas, and they use a very clever technique to observe these TV gamma rays. In fact, they use the Earth atmosphere as a TV gamma ray detector. How? If a TV gamma ray impinges on the upper atmosphere of the Earth, it pair produces. There's an electromagnetic cascade that starts. The pairs, the electron and positron pairs, now propagate with velocity that's larger than light speed in the atmosphere. They emit a flash of Cherenkov emission. This blue light is then collected in these telescopes, and then basically the initial energy and arrival direction of the photon is being reconstructed. So thanks to the heroic work of these three collaborations, we now have a picture of the TV gamma ray sky that grew over the last decade. You can clearly see the galactic plane here. These are galactic coordinates. And there are different source classes here, ranging from pulsars, black hole binaries, and supernova remnants. And there's also an extragalactic component, which is dominated by these red bullet points, all of which are thought to be blazars. That's quite interesting. So we're talking about the dominant extragalactic source population at TeV energies. Now, what happens if a blazar emits a TV photon? It travels, and at some point, it encounters a photon from the extragalactic background light, so the light that is emitted by all the galaxies and quasars in the universe. If the center of mass energy of this reaction exceeds twice the electron's rest mass, they can pair produce an electron and a positron. Now, taking the cross-section of this reaction and divide this by the target density of photons gives us the mean free path. And that ranges from 35 megaparsecs up to 700 megaparsecs, depending on the number of target photons. And because the heights of galaxy formations are not today, but at redshift 1 or so, that mean free path drops considerably towards higher redshifts, redshift 1. What happens next? Well, it was thought that these TeV or half a TeV pairs now can upscatter photons from the cosmic microwave background. If you now have a photon that has 10 to the minus 3 electron volts, encounters a TeV electron or TeV positron, it will produce a GeV, or in fact, 1,000 GeV photons. And the mean free path through that reaction is 1,000 times smaller than that one. Now, to summarize, we started with a TeV photon, and we should get 1,000 GeV photons, a point source. People looked for this emission. This is the spectrum of a detected blazar. Neronov and Wolf then reconstructed the intrinsic spectrum, and they computed the expected cascade emission because of this process I just told you about. And this emission is not there. These are Fermi exclusion regions. This emission has not yet been seen in any blazar spectrum. Let's go back to the drawing board. What's wrong? This is pair production, and this is inverse Compton emission. These are textbook mechanisms, and we hope those are right. So what are we missing in this picture? Well, the argument by Neronov and Wolf was, imagine there are intergalactic magnetic fields. They would deflect the pairs so that the GeV photons don't really make it into our line of sight. And this, of course, would reduce the flux, the GeV flux. So the GeV point source would be diluted, and instead of a point source becomes a weak pair halo. And we will hear more about this by Avery later on in this workshop. Now, the stronger the B field, the more deflection there is, and the more GeV dilution. A non-detection of gamma rays implies the lower limit of the magnetic fields, and this made a lot of fuss. So people actually claimed perhaps they can constrain primordial fields using this mechanism. Well, there's a problem for the unified AGN model. Because if you believe this, there's no increase in the co-moving blazar density with redshift allowed, which is seen in all the other AGN sources, since otherwise the extragalactic GeV background would be overproduced. And we'll come back to this point. Now, let's go back. What else could happen to these pairs? Well, they're not flying through empty space. And during this AstroPH discussion about 4 years or 5 years ago, Avery mentioned the possibility that, wait a second, these pairs actually encounter a plasma. They encounter the intergalactic medium as they propagate. So you have not a situation, a pair flying through empty space, but a pair of electron and positrons flying through a plasma of the intergalactic medium. And this configuration is unstable in principle to plasma instabilities. With plasma instabilities now, you have to basically look at the characteristic frequencies and length scales of the problem. So that's the plasma frequency and the length scale, the plasma skin depth, which is just C divided by omega P, which is of order 1,000 kilometers. It's tiny compared to any cosmological scale that we have here. Now, let me explain to you a very simplistic physical view of what may happen, and I take the simplest example possible, the two-stream instability. Consider we have a wave-like perturbation in the background plasma along the beam direction. so a longitudinal wave, which is called the Langmuir wave, which is shown here, the potential of this. And imagine now we have an initially inhomogeneous beam of electrons that pass in a direction here. So the electrons feel an attractive force by the maxima and a repulsive force by the potential minima. So that means they're slowed down here. And if you know what happens if you slow down a stream of particles, and that happens if you go to Toronto and the 401, a traffic jam happens, right? So that means you basically slow down the electrons here, and you slow down the positrons at the potential maxima here. Both of them are basically caused to be bunched up. So the beam pairs couple, therefore, in phase with the background perturbation, and this enhances the background potential. This, in turn, implies a stronger force on the beam pairs, which is a positive feedback loop. This implies an exponential wave growth and an instability. Wait a second. There's one important thing we have to basically consider. Imagine we have particles that have a velocity larger than phase velocity. There will therefore be a mean transfer of pair momentum to plasma waves. And this is exactly what you need to have growing modes or to have an instability. If the particles have a velocity that is less than the phase speed, there will be a mean transfer of the plasma wave momentum to the pairs, which is what we call Landau damping. So a necessary condition for instability is that we have more particles with a higher velocity than phase speed, so we have a positive slope of the distribution function with velocity. And in fact, this is what we have. We inject our particles with a gamma factor of 10 to the 6. So that's not a problem to start with. Now, real life is more complicated. In real life, the alignment of the perturbations is not aligned with the beam direction, and it's the sum of all possible orientations. And it turns out, Anton worked on this, that the oblique instability grows faster than the two-stream, so with some arbitrary angle with respect to the beam direction. The reason, the physical reason for this is that the electric fields can easier deflect the ultra-relativistic particles and change their parallel velocities. And this is an image that I actually stole off one of your papers. It basically shows the growth rate as a function of alignment with respect to the beam direction. If the alignment is in the direction of the beam, that's the two-stream instability I just talked about. If the alignment is perpendicular to the beam, that's the Weibull instability. And you see neither of those grows fastest. The growth rate is maximized at some angle in between here, at an oblique angle. And that's what an oblique instability, at least in simple terms, is. Now, back to our problem at hand. Consider now we have a light beam that penetrates into a relatively dense plasma. There will be a maximum growth rate that scales with the gamma factor of the pairs times the ratio of the beam to the background density times the eigenfrequency of the plasma, omega p. And if you plot now this growth rate as a function of energy, it rises. Interestingly, it rises, or the normalization is higher by a factor of 10 to 100 in comparison to the cooling rate due to inverse Compton emission. And this means, if true, you can forget about inverse Compton emission, and the oblique instability will determine the past evolution or future evolution of those pairs. Now, of course, this is only the growth rate in the linear regime. And there will hopefully be a lot of discussion about the saturation of this growth rate in the nonlinear regime. I won't go into this. I will leave this to some other speakers that will talk after me. For the remainder of this talk, I assume now that this is always the case, and look what happens if this is indeed true. Now, to summarize this, we started with a TV photon that pair produced off a photon from the extragalactic background light. It was thought that these pairs Compton upscattered the CMB via inverse Compton cascades to give rise to GV photons. But there's now a second possibility that plasma instabilities are means by channeling the kinetic energy of the pairs to collective energy in the waves of the background. This means these GV photons are not there, and this has significant implications for intergalactic magnetic field estimates and for the unified picture of TV blazars and quasars. Let me explain each of these points in turn. What about the intergalactic magnetic fields? Well, again, there's a competition of rates. There's the inverse Compton growth, cooling rate, and there's the oblique instability growth rate. We can define now a fraction, so the inverse Compton cooling rate divided by the sum of both rights, which is the fraction of the pair energy that is lost to the inverse Compton on the CMB. And if you plot this fraction as a function of luminosity of the sources, you can see the fraction of inverse Compton cooling is minimized for luminous blazar sources. So the plasma instabilities dominate for the more luminous blazars. But in turn, it also means if you want to observe a pair halo, you should go to the low luminosity objects, 10 to the 41, 10 to the 42 ergs per second. So perhaps you can see the pair halos there, if this is right.
Can you say something about the mean free path in different processes?
So the mean free path is basically related to the growth rate. So the mean free path for the inverse Compton emission is about 1,000 times smaller than the initial mean free path. So we talk about 30 kiloparsecs to 100 kiloparsecs. And depending on the saturation of the nonlinear instability, it can be shorter or longer. So really, the question is, at which level do the instabilities saturate? In linear regime, it's shorter. So we talk about a few kiloparsecs. But that may not be the relevant scale to talk about. All right. Now, concluding this part, it was thought that TV blazar spectra might constrain IGMB fields. This assumes that the cooling mechanism is inverse Compton scattering off of the CMB plus deflection from the magnetic fields. The beam instabilities allow high energy pairs to self-scatter and or lose energy. This would then isotropize the beam. There's no need for a B field to do this. And the plot I showed to you on the previous page demonstrated that 1 to 10% of the beam energy is only then lost to inverse Compton CMB photons. So that means blazar spectra are not suitable to measure IGMB fields if the plasma instabilities saturate close to the linear rate. And that's a big if, I have to say. Now, moving on, what about the gamma ray regime? We collected the luminosity of 23 TV blazars with good spectral measurements, account for selection effects, sky coverage, duty cycle, galactic occultation, the TV flux limit, and plotted the luminosity density, binned up basically as a function of blazar luminosity. And then AV realized, wait, this looks like a scaled version of the luminosity density of quasars, that's the black line, today. In fact, it's 0.2% of that of quasars. Well, that could be a coincidence, but it's a very interesting coincidence. It would then imply that quasars and TV blazars are regulated by the same mechanism, and you say, wait, that's what is underlying the unified AGN picture. Yes, but you have always a problem, and then you can't explain the extragalactic gamma ray background, because there you have to break this unified picture. And at least it says that both of them are contemporaneous elements of a single AGN population, that TV blaze activity does not lack the quasar activity. And that will make a second big assumption. Now, for the remainder of the talk, I assume that the blazar and the quasar luminosity density trace each other for all other redshifts, because we can't obviously observe TV blazars at higher redshifts, at least not the full population, single objects maybe. And then how do we test this picture? Well, we have to go and look at the GEV gamma ray sky that the LAT experiment on Fermi gave us. So we can use the resolved Fermi hard gamma ray blazar counts to test the low redshift hypothesis, and the extragalactic gamma ray background to test the high redshift part. We did this. Blue are the latest data points for the number of resolved blazars as a function of redshift. And you can see here the bint histogram of our model, which nicely follows the data. Why is this? First of all, blazars are intrinsically low luminosity subpopulations of IGN. And second, Fermi has a fixed flux limit. Okay, so check mark. So this works. What about the log n log s distribution? So that's the cumulative number of blazars as a function of blazar flux above 10 GeV. And in fact, the data is shown here. Our model is overplotted. It's not ruled out. In fact, the predicted and observed flux distribution of hard Fermi blazars are indistinguishable. All right. So in terms of resolved objects, we can't rule out that model. What about the unresolved objects? Can we actually constrain them in this model? Then we have to understand what happens about the photon absorption due to pair production. So imagine the intrinsic spectrum of a hard blazar looks like this. It's a rising power law. It peaks at some point and declines. If we then place this spectrum to redshift 1, first of all, we get the spectrum redshifted on the way to us. And second, the pair, the gamma ray flux at high energies is attenuated due to the pair production. And this effect is stronger the higher the energy is. This basically effectively softens the spectra. And in the Fermi band, the index is now harder that you measure. Now, if we plot the locus of the observed spectral index in the Fermi band as a function of redshift, and blue are all the blazars that Fermi saw, these lines, the mean 1 and 2 sigma, nicely scrape the locus of those BLUX in this space. So at least we have a working model to explain the population here. And now we use this model to constrain the exogalactic gamma ray background. So we have our two power law model that I explained to you before. We take this spectrum, normalize it by the quasar luminosity density as a function of redshift times the blazar fraction, so this is the 0.2%, divide by 4 pi d squared to get a flux, times e to the minus tau to get this attenuation factor, integrate over the cosmic volume, and get the spectrum of the unresolved sources that's shown here. So that's now the spectrum of all unabsorbed sources. If you take into account this e to the minus tau factor, so this absorption, we obtain the dashed line. And if you now cut out all the local sources that are resolved, we get at the solid line. No free parameter, it simply matches the data. Again, could be a coincidence, but maybe it's not. So the evolving population of hard blazars provides an excellent match to the latest EGRB by Fermi, above at least 3 GeV. So below that, there are other blazar populations like the FSRQs that could be responsible for this. So to my mind, or in my to my mind, the blazar heating, or sort of the removal of the integral between the unabsorbed and absorbed one, and the fact that we don't actually sort of cascade this down here, is the only way to make an evolving population work with the data. The only other way would be if you basically have this area here under the curves reprocessed to lower energy, would be they have to constrain the redshift evolution of those blazars. That's another possibility, but of course that breaks unification, which we would like to have.
Could you just repeat these, your intrinsic two spectral break that you assumed?
You said, that's a good point.
Yeah, okay.
So yes. So we assumed a single high energy spectrum, and we assumed an intrinsic population that we draw from the local observed spectral distributions of Fermi.
Yeah, but what causes the spread?
What physically, I mean, at this point we are ignorant, so it may be Kleine-Schema or something else. I mean, so that's basically just motivated by the observed spectra of local blazars. But yeah, it's an interesting question. What really caused this plague? I mean,
if you would just take a straight power law, you would not get agreement with the data.
It would be harder. That's true, because there's more and more energy than here if you have a rising one. So at some point, you would have to break this. Otherwise, you have to constrain this direct evolution. But it's a very interesting point. All right. So I told you what the absence of GeV gamma rays or about these implications of the absence of GeV gamma rays. What about the other part? Are there any positive effects we have from the plasma instabilities? And the answer is yes, because the energy is channeled to collective momenta in the waves, and that, by interacting, could heat the universe. And this would then have an implication on the thermal history of the intergalactic medium, the Lyman Alpha Forest, and the late time formation of dwarf galaxies. But before we dive into the details, let's do an order of magnitude check. The first idea we had is like it's crazy, right? The total power from AGNs and stars certainly exceeds the TV power of quasars. And I told you it's 0.2% of that of quasars. So naively, you would guess, let's forget about this. It's only a sort of less than a percent effect. That's not the case. Let's go through the math. The intergalactic medium is observed to be at a temperature of 10 to the 4 Kelvin, with a particle energy of 1 electron volt at the mean density at redshift 2. So that means the rest mass fraction is 10 to the minus 9. The radiative energy ratio that is emitted by all black holes in the universe is the radiative efficiency, 0.1% usually taken, times the density parameter of black holes, which is about 10 to the minus 4. So this is 10 to the minus 5. Only 10% of that energy is emitted in the UV, so it's energetic enough to ionize hydrogen. So we get at an UV energy fraction of 10 to the minus 6 times a GeV. So that means the IGM should be at a temperature of kV. It's not. It's observed to be at a temperature of an EV. Therefore, the photoheating efficiency that you can infer from this is 10 to the minus 3. It's tiny. Why is this? Well, you need to have a neutral hydrogen to ionize it. If you ionized hydrogen once, you have to wait until it recombines, and this takes about a Hubble time. That's the reason why this photoheating efficiency is so small. All taken together, of course, you get the EV temperature. What about blazar heating? The heating efficiency is 10 to the minus 3, which is just what we derived from comparing the blazar and the quasar luminosity densities. So that means the temperature is this efficiency, 10 to the minus 3, times the radiative energy ratio, 10 to the minus 5, times MPC squared, that is 10 eV. It's 10 times the temperature you get in a standard universe. Why? Because it's only limited by the total power of sources. There's no additional rate limiting step that you have to take into account. So despite the fact that you have an energy that is vastly subdominant, it can make a huge difference in principle. All right, so Phil coded this up into a linear code, and this is now the temperature evolution in the linear code as a function of redshift. So hydrogen reionization, adiabatic expansion of the universe, helium reionization, adiabatic expansion, and photoheating is what you would expect in a standard universe. Now, switching on blazar heating, it will kick in after helium recombination and give rise to temperatures that are 10 times higher at mean density than you would have this in a standard universe. All right. Now, you may say, that's fine. Why should I care? Let's look at the evolution of the temperature density relation. That's the standard universe temperature density relation, where the temperature increases with density. Now, blazars in the extragalactic background light are uniform. So that means the blazar heating rate is independent of density. That means you heat every patch of the universe with the same amount of energy. If there are less particles, if you go towards, every particle gets more energy. And that means you make the low density regions hot. And asymptotically, you get an inverted temperature density relation where the temperature goes like 1 over the density. So that means if you go towards the voids, the temperature should be hotter. And this is a big effect if you put those two plots on the same scale. And at late redshift, so redshift 1 and 0.5, so this is then green and red, you can see the big difference this makes at mean density in voids.
So, Christopher,
yes.
Why is a 1 over delta not a 1 over rho? Because the mean density itself will also, you know.
So
should be 1 over 1 plus delta, right?
Yes, that's, you're right, yes, it's 1 over 1 plus delta, yes.
So then, you know, that actually makes the fence a little bit
yes.
better, because if your delta is small, actually that's basically a beautiful.
Absolutely, no, I agree, yes. So blazars completely change the thermal history of the diffuse IGM in a late time structure formation. That's the bottom-up shot. But late time may be too late. So that needs to be looked at in great detail, and I think Matt McMinn will talk about this. Now, what we did, we wanted to sort of go ahead and test this because we have a great cosmic thermometer, the Lyman Alpha Forest. So we include the predicted volumetric heating rate in cosmological hydrodynamical simulations to study the thermal properties of the intergalactic medium and the Lyman Alpha Forest. And this was work done by Ewald Puchwein, who unfortunately cannot be here today, but Martin Handel will, I guess, give some of his results, impersonating him, I guess. All right, so what he found is the temperature density relation in the standard universe, in the universe of blazar heating, and as expected, you can see now the void to become hot in such a universe. All right, how can we measure this? Well, the Lyman Alpha Forest is a perfect thermometer, as I already said, so it looks at the Lyman Alpha flux that is redshifted, and every time it basically encounters a neutral hydrogen cloud, you see an absorption line. Now, in the real universe, you see many absorption lines, and that's why it's called the Lyman Alpha Forest. And of course, the location corresponds to the redshift of these absorption systems. Now, we can simulate this. We can actually simulate the Lyman Alpha Forest. And this is the transmitted flux fraction in our simulations. Green is a universe with blazar heating. Dotted is a universe without blazar heating. And you can immediately see by eye there's a difference. There's a higher transmitted flux fraction in universe with blazar heating. Why? A hotter temperature ionizes more of the stuff, and that means you don't absorb as many photons. That's the simple reason for this big difference here. And you know, the difference is not small. It can go up to a quarter or so for individual lines. Now, of course, you cannot look at this individually. You have to do statistics over all possible lines. And before we do so, let me talk about one complication. So you can, of course, look at the effective optical depth as a function of redshift. And unfortunately, we don't know the photoheating rate. That means you have to rescale the simulated effective optical depth to the observed one at all the redshifts. And even after doing so, you can see that the temperature as a function of redshift, so this is time going leftwards, basically, in fact, in universes with blazar heating, these are the different colored lines, seem to agree with the data that George Becker produced, and Martin Handel was on his paper, so it must be right. Yes. There is hydrogen helium heat recombination, so that should be over by redshift 2.7. If it's still increasing down to redshift 2, that is interesting. So redshift evolutions of the effective optical depth and the IGM temperature match data only with the additional heating provided, for instance, by blazars. Now, you can take a spectrum, you chunk up this into pieces, and you histogram the probability distribution function of the transmitted flux fraction. So that's what's shown here. Or different redshifts. So these are parts where you have a high transmitted flux fractions, so voids or mean densities. And here you can see that the blazar models do much better to basically match the data in comparison to a universe without blazar heating, even after tuning to the observed UV background. Now it's a 1-point PDF. You can look at the power spectra, so 2-point statistics, and again, in universe with blazar heating and on large scales, you match the observed power spectra. Even though we simulated the universe with the observed normalization sigma 8 of 0.8 for the cosmologists here. In the standard universe, you can see you don't match the normalization here, and that's why the people that did this business had to adjust the overall normalization of the power spectrum to increase sigma 8 to make it slightly inconsistent now with the WMAP and Planck constraints. So you can match the constraints if you include blazar heating. And this, of course, lowers the required sigma 8 to the observed values. That's nice. To conclude on this part, the improvement in modeling the lime alpha forest is a direct consequence of the peculiar properties of blazar heating. The heating rate is independent of IgM density. This naturally produces the inverted temperature density relation that the Lyman alpha forest data demand, and the recent and continuous nature of the heating is needed to match the density evolutions of all the Lyman alpha forest statistics. The magnitude of the heating rate required by Lyman alpha forest data is approximately equal to the total energy output of TV blazars, or equivalently 0.2% of that of quasars. So, but bottom line, again, the Lyman alpha forest cannot rule out blazar heating. In fact, it may be needed, but you can discuss things how other ways are there basically to sort of solve these problems. It certainly cannot be ruled out, which was a big surprise to us. We thought heating up the universe by a factor of 10, you can easily rule this model out. Turns out that's not that easy. Finally, coming to the last part, what about structure formation? And I think this is the most uncertain part in this talk. So it's still not clear actually how big the effect of blazar heating would be on structure formation. Now, what is one of the problems that you encounter here? It's in the cold dark matter universe, we are expected to have many, many substructures within the halo of the Milky Way. And this is one of Volcker's beautiful simulations. That's the Aquarius halo. And you have certainly many more substructures compared to the observed luminous content of dwarfs surrounding us and the local group. Now, how do dwarfs form? Well, on small scales, the summit pressure poses the gravitational collapse. This sets a characteristic mass and a characteristic length scale below which objects do not form. That's in two sentences the idea of how a galaxy or dwarf galaxy forms. Now, what is this characteristic mass? Well, it's the so-called Jeans mass. The hotter the intergalactic medium, the higher the thermal pressure, the higher the Jeans mass. The Jeans mass scales with the sound speed to the third power divided by the density to the 1/2 power. So it scales as a temperature to the 3/2 power. If we now take a Jeans mass in the universe with blazar heating and divide this by the Jeans mass in the photoheated only universe, you can see this is equal to the temperature ratio, which is 10 to the 3/2 at mean density, which is a factor of 30. So this means you suppress the formation of dwarfs in the universe with blazar heating by a factor of 30 compared to universes without blazar heating. So at least basically due to this very simple estimate, that's a huge effect. That's true. That is true. But there are possibilities that actually this makes an effect. If you look at the low densities, structural formation slow down in voids, like people's void phenomenon. So there are some indications. And there are other indications. But I completely agree. I mean, that needs to be worked out in detail. But there are certain aspects that this still may be able to affect. Like it could heat up the surrounding circumgalactic medium out of which galaxies accrete their matter today, and that could actually be changed. So maybe it's not the order unity effect, but maybe this is only a small effect that works there. I completely agree. So there are as well complications with this Jeans mass argument. The collapse is nonlinear, and the matter responds nonlinearly in an expanding universe, and therefore the concept of the filtering mass has been introduced by Nick Nadin. So I computed then the filtering mass as a function of redshift. In the standard universe, due to linear theory, it increases due to hydrogen reionization, and then it sort of saturates here down to a level of 10 to the 11. If you now include blazar heating, that would now suppress the formation of galaxies up to a scale of 10 to the 12 solar masses today. Now, it was found that if you run simulations, that is not quite right, and the nonlinear theory predicted filtering masses lower. And Matt McQuinn, I think, now wrote a very beautiful paper explaining why this is the case. But nevertheless, if you basically take the same suppression factor and adopt this also to the blazar models, you can see that now there's a new time scale, so between redshift 1 and 2, and a new mass scale introduced if blazar heating really works. that suppresses galaxy formation at these scales. All right, let me come, let's see, how much time do I still have? 3 minutes? Okay, let me sort of do this last bit here. Next question, when do dwarfs form? And that's what Martin actually alluded to. So people do this isochrone fitting in color magnitude space to infer as a function of age and metallicity, when do the stars in these dwarfs form? And you can see this gives us basically a history, star formation history in these dwarfs. Now people did this for all the local group dwarfs, and they don't want you to sort of look at the details here. I want you to take away that in all these dwarfs there's a red part. So these are the first stars formed in dwarfs that have always formed before a lookback time of 10 giga years or at a time earlier than a redshift of 2. That's the bottom line upshot here. Now, if you believe some semi-analytic models, they would predict that a fraction, about one third of the Milky Way satellites have accreted, have formed after redshift of 2. And there was a big puzzle pointed out, and these authors, Makio and Fontano, sort of said you need to actually increase your filtering mass to sort of suppress the formation of those dwarfs. So placer heating does the job, but maybe some other mechanism can do also this job. It suppresses the late satellite formation and may reconcile the low observed dwarf abundances with the CDM simulations. But of course, this will be checked, and Till Zavala will actually give a talk about the first simulations, so local group simulations that include now placer heating. Let me come to the conclusions now on placer heating. In a bottom-up shot, TV photons are attenuated by the EBL. Their kinetic energy is used for heating the IGM. It is not cascaded to GEV energies. If true, this explains puzzles in gamma-ray astrophysics, the lack of GEV bumps in the blazer spectra without going to evoke intergalactic magnetic fields. It unifies the TV blazars and the quasars and explains the Fermi source count as well as the extragalactic gamma-ray background. It's a novel mechanism that dramatically alters the thermal history of the IGM. It is characterized by uniform and redshift-dependent preheating, and it provides a quantitatively self-consistent picture of the high redshift lambda alpha forest. And finally, it could significantly modify the late-time structure formation, suppress late dwarf formation, and perhaps explain the void phenomenon voiced by Peebles. And I don't know how much it may help in reconciling the missing satellites problem. Thanks a lot for your attention.
So we have a little bit of time for questions. During that time, I'll get you to. Okay, you go ahead first, and then.
Naive question, maybe. Right at the beginning, you said that the TEV photons, gamma, have been detected.
Yes.
So if they have been detected, are we sure they give rise to pairs?
Yes, the horizon has been detected by Fermi. So if you now stack a number of AGN sources, you can see that the characteristic roll-off basically, let's see, if you go to and you stack them at the same redshift and you have different redshift bins, you can see that the cutoff decreases in energy with increasing redshift. That's one way of looking at this. But you can also, and I guess Jim Hinton is sort of giving more insight into this, and I think we are pretty sure that this exists and this mechanism has to be there. Mm. I think people still talk about the exact size and so on. I mean, they're still not quite settled there, but I think it's no question that this effect exists.
Okay.
So how do you get this laser heating rate from the factor of 10 to the minus 3?
Oh, this is just by comparing the luminosity density here.